Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
And welcome. Thursdays mean 2 hours of question and answer open forum, and that means your participation. You provide the questions, and Catholic Answers will provide the answers, the Catholic Answers, obviously. Senior apologist Jimmy Akin is here this hour, Mark Brumley in hour number two, and phone lines are wide open for you right now. First come, first served at 888-318-7884. Basically, anything goes. We can talk to you about sacraments, papacy, Mary, theology, religion, spirituality, prayer. Yeah, you get the idea. Q&A open forum at 888-318-7884. I'm Jerry Usher, in for Cy Kellett. I thought my three-day run of hosting yesterday was over, but parting is such sweet sorrow. It's so sorrowful that Jimmy and I just couldn't say goodbye to each other. So here I'm back again.
How nice, you doing, Jimmy? Nice to talk to you, Hamlet.
Yeah, right. Right. Well, Cy had a little trouble getting back home from his engagement, so I presume he'll be in tomorrow, but I get the honor of working with Jimmy for the third time this week. Wow.
How about that?
Yeah, man, absolutely. All right, so start dialing that phone line at 888-318-7884 with whatever you would like to ask Jimmy this hour. And, Jimmy, I know that you're always following the proceedings in the Eternal City in Rome, and I know the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, I don't know if you'd describe it as the guardian of doctrine in the church. I guess that's why they call it that. But they put out a new document. You wanted to describe a little bit.
Yeah. So I was interested to discover today that the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, or CDF for short, had released a new document. They don't do that very often. They hadn't released anything since 2016, and before that it was 2012 since they'd released anything. So it's something that seems to happen only every few years these days. And this new document is on the subject of salvation. And at the press conference introducing it, the current head of the CDF, Archbishop Luis Ladaria, said that it had arisen after some theologians had begun writing the congregation, asking them to elaborate on some things that had been discussed in an earlier document called Dominus Iesus, which came out back in the year 2000. And that document was devoted to the church's teaching on the fact that Jesus Christ is the unique Savior of all mankind. And it had been controversial because some people thought that that was some kind of slight against other religions. And that's an objection that we hear in apologetics sometimes. Like, what do you mean saying Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, that he's the way you need to go if you want to be saved and so forth. And so they do mention Dominus Iesus in the new document, but really what they're mostly talking about is a couple of themes that are out there in the culture connected with salvation that Pope Francis has been talking about. One of these themes is a kind of self-sufficient individualism where a person thinks, well, I just need to be a good person, and by my own efforts, I can achieve salvation. And they might view Jesus as like an example to inspire good works, like helping the poor or something, but they don't really give him his full due as he's the one who saves us. It's because of his grace that we're able to be saved. It's not something we can just rely on ourselves for. The other tendency is one to kind of internalize salvation and treat it as just a purely personal and spiritual thing, kind of a me and Jesus attitude that it's sometimes been termed, where you don't really focus on anything but your interior relation with Jesus. You don't realize that you have obligations to other Christians and other people and to the church and to the whole of the created world, that we're not just disembodied spirits, but that God made us to be both physical and spiritual, and the physical has and the external has a place in the realm of salvation as well. In fact, our ultimate destiny, despite some popular cartoons you may see, is not to, you know, be disembodied spirits sitting on clouds for all eternity. We're going to be re-embodied at the resurrection of the dead. So the physical and the external is definitely part of the realm of salvation that's being affected by God's grace. And so that's what the document is principally about. It also notes that Pope Francis has referred to these two tendencies, kind of comparing them to the ancient heresies of Pelagianism and Gnosticism. Pelagianism was a heresy back in the 5th century that said that you don't really need God's grace to be saved. You can do it by your own effort. And Gnosticism was a heresy from the 2nd and 3rd centuries. It was kind of complex, but did focus on a lot of kind of ethereal speculations and kind of dissed the physical world, viewed the physical world as a bad place that was made by an inferior divine being, not the ultimate and true divine, wellspring of divine goodness. So it's an interesting document, and I have a piece going up on Catholic.com to explain it tomorrow.
Very good. Are these available on the Vatican website, by the way?
Yes, and I link to where you can read the piece in my article that's coming up.
Okay, good. Because sometimes, you know this, Jimmy, better than I do, sometimes we lay Catholics think, well, these documents are for the bishops and the priests and apologists like you, but I know you wouldn't join me in encouraging everyone to follow that link and actually read the document.
Absolutely.
Okay. It's an open forum here on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is here, senior apologist at Catholic Answers, and he'll be followed in hour number two by Mark Brumley. So, Jimmy, you all set for questions?
I'm ready.
Okay, we're going to go to Sacramento first. Andrew, watching on YouTube, greetings to you, Andrew, and welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I wanted to say, I know, Jimmy, you wrote a commentary on Mark. I have not gotten mm-hmm. it yet. However, I'm kind of doing my own study, and I came across something interesting, and that is in the Revised Standard Version of Mark chapter 5, verse 2.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed that in the Greek, there's the word immediately, metheos, which uh-huh. is used throughout Mark. And I was just wondering why in the RSV it's left out, whereas other translations, they have it.
Yeah, so the word for immediately in Greek, euthus, is part of Mark's style, and he uses it constantly in his gospel. And I talk about this in my commentary. He just uses euthus over and over and over again. And he's actually kind of – I mean, it's his personal style, but he's actually kind of breaking good Greek style, what was considered good Greek style by most authors. Some have even kind of disparagingly referred to the way he uses this word as a kind of verbal tick. But it is at least one of his pet words that he likes to use as a way of bringing drama and immediacy to his narrative. It's kind of like when you're telling a story and you just say, and immediately this happened. And you may not mean the word immediately literally, but you kind of throw it in as a way of emphasizing the dramatic nature of whatever you're talking about. And that seems to be what Mark is doing. And he may be picking that up from Peter, because Mark's gospel is based on Peter's reminiscences. And so he heard Peter's oral recitation on many occasions of the different stories about Jesus. And Peter may well have been using this word as part of his oral presentation, which tends to be less formal than a written presentation would be. People have noted that Mark's gospel tends to read not exactly like a transcript, but something like a transcript of an oral performance of the gospel. And other gospels like Matthew and Luke that use Mark are conspicuously delete this word. euthus in their parallels to the same passages, because they're not doing the kind of informal oral style performance of the gospel. They're doing a more literary style performance of it in writing, and they are reconfiguring the language so that it more closely fits expected Greek literary or written style. So they eliminate the word. And that's basically why you don't find the word here in the Revised Standard Version. The translators of the Revised Standard Version, like Matthew and Luke, said, you know, this word, even though Mark threw it in the Greek, it doesn't really fit established English literary style. We don't have the word immediately thrown in on all these occasions. People might say it when they're talking, but they don't just throw it in when they're writing. And so they made a decision as translators to use English literary style in translating these passages. And like Matthew and Luke, they ended up dropping the euthus because it's not essential for meaning. It's just a matter of style.
What do you think, Andrew? Does that fit in with your – it's great to hear that you're doing an in-depth study of Mark as well. Anything follow-up on that, Andrew?
It's excellent. I just wanted to make sure. I'm saying the word wrong. It's not euthus.
No, it's euthus.
Euthus. Okay, good. Okay, excellent. No, that satisfies my question. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Thanks, Andrew. And we're going to get to August and Eric and Angel and John and another Andrew. All of you standing by for our open forum Q&A. Jimmy Akin is here to provide the answers to your questions today. Right here. Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back.
Can you trust the basis of the Christian faith? The Christian faith is under constant attack today in numerous ways, but the attack that does the most damage is the one that asks a deceptively simple question. What if your faith is based on a myth? The skeptics come with arguments to cast doubt in numerous ways, often attacking the reliability of the New Testament and the Gospels. And the sad news is that most people don't know how to answer these charges. The good news is that there are answers to each and every one of them. Good, solid answers. That's why Catholic Answers Studios has just released Jimmy Akin's new DVD, The Dawn of Christian History. With his characteristic wit and passion as a master storyteller, Jimmy takes you through an exciting detective story that reveals how history supports the Christian faith. Order your copy of The Dawn of Christian History today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
We struggle with sin. We're distracted in prayer. We find it hard to be loving and easy to be selfish. Thankfully, the Church has given us Lent, the perfect time for reform, of reconversion to God and His will for us. The saints of the Counter-Reformation faced greater obstacles than these, yet they each found the grace to persevere during a tumultuous time in the Church. How can we do the same? Reform yourself is a good place to start. We all need to reform our souls. This Lent, let the saints who reformed the Church show you how. Order your copy of Reform Yourself today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Come to the right place for the Catholic answers to your questions, 888-318-7884. Just real quickly, before we go back to your calls, we've been telling you about the Catholic Answers 20 Answers Challenge throughout the month of February. And the offer, it was going to end yesterday, and actually there was so much demand. We had, I think, 400 people sign up just yesterday alone, and people are still asking, hey, can I get that 60% discount? So you know the kind heart of the people at Catholic Answers. They have decided just for another limited time, especially online at Catholic.com, if you still want to take, they've left that offer up there just because so many people have taken advantage of it. So huge thumbs up to everybody taking the challenge. It's the 26 volume set of 20 answers on various subjects of the faith. You can still get that if you go to catholic.com and click on the offer there. That'll still be up there for a little while. But also, there's a special Catholic Answers magazine issue on Humanae Vitae, and that'll be the forthcoming May-June issue, and it marks the 50th anniversary of Blessed Pope Paul VI's Humanae Vitae encyclical with an exploration of the crucial social and theological issues surrounding that document. And Jimmy, it has been often misunderstood and certainly misrepresented, but I know this piece in the special Catholic Answers magazine is going to be helpful for people on this anniversary.
Yeah, the whole issue is devoted to it. And so it's got stories by a bunch of different folks on Humanae Vitae and different aspects of it and the birth control issue. I just turned in my article a few days ago, and it's an overview of Humanae Vitae and its broad historical context, so you can see the things that led up to it. And there are some surprising things that led up to it. And then also talks about its legacy and I was pleased. It looks like mine's going to be the cover story because it's kind of a keystone piece that provides an overview of how all the different pieces fit together. And then other people in their articles will be digging down in more depth into particular aspects that you may want to read about.
Okay, well, Catholic Answers Magazine, surprise, surprise, is discounted right now. $10 to $20 off the normal subscription price, depending on whether you get a 1 or 2 year subscription. Plus, you get a free digital subscription, and this is going on until the end of the month of March. And this issue on Humanae Vitae, folks, Pope Paul VI was roundly denounced when he put this out, but it is proven to be certainly prophetic, and here we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of it. So don't miss out on what's going to be a virtual handbook on the most important aspects of that profound document. Go to Catholic.com, subscribe to 1 or 2 years of Catholic Answers Magazine, and get that discount of $10 or $20 and the free digital subscription. All right, August is in Joshua, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Hello, Joshua, or excuse me, August. Welcome to the program.
How are y'all doing?
Good.
I just wanted to quick backdrop to my question. The reason I kind of started looking at this was an allegation launched by a gentleman who was a Baptist I used to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Talked about the tearing of the veil of the sanctuary during the crucifixion, that was the abolition of the priesthood.
Okay.
But mine is coming from, I'm trying to figure out, because I know that the word priest comes from the word presbyteros, which is used for typically rendered presbyter, at least in the New American Bible I have.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to find out where the right correlation was. I started looking up the most occurrences I found of the Old Testament priests in the New Testament, like when Peter was arrested for preaching the word. They used the word, I'm going to probably pronounce this wrong, but it was Heros or Herios.
Hieros.
And I was trying to figure out kind of like how, because if a priest comes from presbyteros, I was kind of trying to figure out how the word got taken from mm-hmm. its correlation to the New Testament priesthood and applied to the Old Testament priesthood.
Okay.
And then, like I said, because like in my rendering, my Bible where it says presbyteros is rendered
gotcha.
Presbyteros.
Gotcha. So there are four terms that are relevant here. The first term is the Hebrew word for priest, which is Kohen. And it means what you would think it means. It means a priest. And it could be used and was used of the Jewish priesthood in the Old Testament, but it could also be used of the equivalent in other religions and of priests who weren't Jews. And so it's just a general term referring to a certain kind of religious officer. And the normal Greek translation from that, or I should say of Kohen, is hieros. And that's the term that we find in the Septuagint and later on in the New Testament when they're talking about priests. It's the normal term when they're talking about priests, whether it's Old Testament priests or pagan priests or whatever it may be. Melchizedek, who was an Old Testament priest but not a Jewish priest, he's an example of that. So the ordinary Greek word for priest was hieros. The word that the English word priest comes from, though, is, as you say, the Greek word presbyteros. And presbyteros literally means elder. So if you were an old man, you could be referred to as a presbyteros. If you – in some cases, just the mere fact you were an old man would result in you being called that. But the term also came to be used as a designation for certain kinds of leaders, because usually leaders were older. Young men tend not to be leaders, especially in these ancient societies. They didn't place the same kind of value on youth that our culture has, which is kind of obsessed with youth. And so if you really wanted to rise to a position of leadership in the ancient world, you tended to be older. And so leaders of one kind or another were often older men, and they were often called elders, or in Greek, presbyteroi. The kind of leadership you exercised could be social. You might be a social leader and be called an elder, or it could be religious. And we find religious elders leading both in the Jewish community and in the Christian community. Over the course of time, as the English language developed, and English really doesn't go back 2,000 years. It goes back about 800 years, a little more than that. But as English began to develop out of earlier languages, it has principally a Germanic base, but it also has a lot of loan words from Latin and Greek and French. And as English began to develop, it took the word presbyteros from Greek, meaning elder or presbyter. They mean the same thing. And used as an officer for the church, and it kind of anglicized that and shortened it into the word priest. So presbyteros became priest in English. That's where the word comes from. It's not the original Greek or the standard Greek word for priest. That's hieros. But both hieros and presbyteros came to merge in English in the word priest. Really, they both refer to a certain kind of mid-level, mid-ranking church official or mid-ranking religious official if you're broadening out beyond the Christian church. So you can talk about Jewish priests and Buddhist priests and Hindu priests and whatever you want. It's just a general term across languages for a kind of mid-level religious officer. And in English, we have that one word that is the most common for that, priest. But in Greek, they had a couple of different words that ended up getting merged in English. And that's just the kind of thing that happens across languages. Sometimes there will be a single word for something in English and different words in the original languages. Or sometimes you get the reverse. Sometimes you'll get a single word. And this actually happens a lot with English. Sometimes you'll have a single word in Greek or Hebrew that then gets more than one word in English. An example of that would be saint. In Greek, the word for a saint is hagios, and in English it gets translated either saint or holy one. But it's the same in Greek. So in the Greek, you'll find passages that talk about Jesus as the hagios of God. And in English, it gets translated as Jesus is the Holy One of God. But you could also translate it Jesus is the saint of God, because it's just the same term in Greek. So this is just something that happens in languages where a single term in one language is represented by more than one term in another language.
All right, August, how's that?
Okay. Yeah, sorry, I didn't want to interrupt.
No, no problem.
So it's kind of just because of like linguistic norms, especially on a book written 2,000 years ago. I just know a lot of people get really hung up about the verbiage of how it's been translated. And I'm like, I got a Greek Hebrew app on my phone, and I have a copy of the Vulgate too, so I can try and compare them all. And I just noticed that, you know, a lot of it just really looks like you have to look at the context, trying to figure out how it's supposed to be translated or.
Mm-hmm.
What you're getting at.
Well, because in the New Testament, the there was a difference in function between being a Levitical priest and being an elder. You know, if I were translating a book of the New Testament, I would tend to translate hierus as priest and presbyteros either as elder or presbyter. But the meanings eventually merge, and they're both references to, as I said, to kind of mid-level religious officers. They're not the highest religious officers. They're not the lowest religious officers. They're kind of mid-level religious officers, and that applies across religions. Incidentally, you mentioned the – and I know we're going to have to go to a break real quick, but you mentioned the tearing of the veil. If that were the end of the priesthood, then why did the apostles continue to worship at the temple? There are a bunch of different meanings that can be seen in the tearing of the temple veil, and you shouldn't be overly restricted to just the one your friend has proposed.
All right. Thanks, August. Another satisfied caller, and more of you are straight ahead. Eric, you're going to be right after this break, and if you are on the line, you are guaranteed you're going to get on the program today. It's 2 hours of Thursday Q&A open forum program on Catholic Answers Live. I'm Jerry Escher in for Cy Kella today. Jimmy will answer more of your questions straight ahead.
Catholic Answers Live.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
I love your show. I was raised in a Southern Baptist environment, in and out of church since I was a teenager. But since listening to your show the last several months, I'm in the process of converting to Catholicism.
Ever since I started listening, I've been learning a lot, and I've been very intrigued by some of the things you guys discuss. I want to learn more, and I have a thirst for learning.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Do you subscribe to Catholic Answers Magazine? We hope, but if not, right now we've got a deal that you're going to love. We've reduced the price and thrown in a free digital subscription when you subscribe. That's right, subscriptions to Catholic Answers Magazine just got cheaper, $10 less on one-year subscriptions and $20 less on two-year subscriptions. And right now, when you purchase a subscription, you get a subscription to the digital edition added to your order for free. With a deal like that, it's the perfect gift for friends, family members, seminarians, your priest, even yourself. When you get right down to it, what other gift has the potential to touch hearts and reap eternal rewards? Log on today to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com and sign up yourself, your friends, and your family for a magazine that is bound to make a difference in their lives and the lives of those they meet. Share the faith. Defend the faith. Catholic Answers Magazine from Catholic Answers, the most trusted name in Catholic apologetics.
Tim Staples, Trent Horn, Cy Kellett, Chris Check, Carlo Broussard. Our On Fire lineup of speakers will inform and inspire your audience to grow in their Catholic faith. For more information on booking a Catholic Answers speaker for your event, visit CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com today.
Your questions get answered here on Tuesdays, and well, every day, Monday through Friday, but it's open forum Tuesdays and Thursdays. Jimmy Akin here to help Eric next, listening on The Rock in Cleveland. Hi, Eric. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, gentlemen. How you doing tonight?
Doing okay.
Doing well, Eric. How about yourself?
Doing pretty well in the rain here, so just trying to listen through the pouring rain. I had a couple quick questions related to human sexuality that I'd like to get both in if we have time for them.
Okay, what's your first question?
Well, just really quick background on me. I'm a revert to the faith. I love this church. I love this faith. So this question is not a challenge. It's more about my own understanding and growth.
Don't worry. What's the question?
And so it's related to the topic of gay marriage. And so my question is this. I understand that we would say that it's not even a marriage, and I understand the reasons why. But when it comes into our law in our country, I think my question is, how do we determine whether something that we know is true should be reflected in the law or whether it should not? And the example I would give is, as Catholics, should we say that everything immoral should be illegal, something like fornication or cohabitation? My question is, how do we draw those lines between the truth of our morality and what's in our laws?
Okay. The purpose of civil law, which is what you're talking about, is the law of the state or what's known as civil law, is not the same entirely as the purpose of the moral law. The purpose of the civil law is to enable societies to run in a good way that promotes human flourishing. And part of that is promoting proper moral behavior. But it's been realized down by every society down through the ages that the civil law can't simply effectively stamp out all immorality. It's not going to happen. People have an inbuilt inclination to sin. We have an inbuilt brokenness as a result of the fall. And simply coming up with the right set of laws in civil law is not going to change that. Ultimately, we have to turn to God for salvation from our sinful tendencies. It's not something that the civil law can fully remedy for us. The civil laws can be a positive influence on morality, but they're not going to get us across the goal line. And also, the civil authorities that are responsible for enforcing the laws have limited resources. And there's no way that they would be able, even if it were possible to criminalize every immoral act, there's no possible way that they could enforce the laws in those situations. It would be crazy. And it would, if they tried to just enforce them across the board, there would be big problems. One of the problems is if they weren't triaging the moral offenses so that they're dealing with the more serious offenses, like, say, murder, as opposed to, I don't know, public nose picking. We'll assume for the moment that public nose picking is a sin, but you know, it's really probably not, but we'll assume it is for the moment just to have an illustration of a very minor sin. So if you just said to the public authorities, go out and as soon as you see any sinful behavior, arrest that person, well, then you would end up arresting a lot more public nose pickers than you would murderers. And that would actually harm society in a number of ways. One is it would let the murderers go free because murder investigations are not being prioritized over nose picking. In addition, when the laws are not effectively enforced, then people learn contempt for the law and they start cutting corners on other laws because they lose respect for the law if they see it's not being enforced in a reasonable way. Also, you would frankly have a problem getting people to go along with such a situation where every single immoral act was criminalized because people would feel that an intolerable burden and a tyranny on them, and they wouldn't be willing to accept that form of government, which means that government would lose its moral legitimacy because it was not reigning with the consent of the governed, and it would likely be overthrown by the people in short order. And we've actually seen just in the last 30 years examples of harsh dictatorial regimes that were overthrown by their people, and it wasn't a pretty sight. So as a result of those factors, prudence and wisdom indicate that the state, while it does want to try to help support the moral order as part of promoting human flourishing, it needs to respect the limits that it's under. Some of those limits are based on resources. You know, how much police power does the state have that it can be throwing into investigating and prosecuting different matters? And then which are the most important matters that need to be dealt with? They need to be prioritized over less important matters. Also, the consent of the governed and what people are willing to tolerate is part of that calculus. And so as responsible citizens, and especially for those who are lawmakers, people need to not have a let's ban everything immoral mentality, but a how can we best promote human flourishing and the moral order, and what limits are there on our ability to do that, and where do we need to cut people slack?
All right. How was that? Did you have a second quick question, Eric?
Well, that was great, and I really appreciate that insight. I think more specifically what I was really asking about was the issue of gay marriage. And my question, I really appreciated those insights, but it's something like the debate over, you know, two men joining their lives and calling it a marriage. Is that more something like murder or theft, where we say that should be illegal, or is it more like something like fornication, where we say it's not true and it's not right, but it really shouldn't be the state enforcing anything?
What the church has said is that that the true reality of marriage should be protected by the law within the limits that a given society is. And the ideal is that, you know, people should be correct in their understanding of marriage, and that should be reflected in the laws of society. Having said that, the church also recognizes that there are some societies where right now that's not happening, and you can't just snap your fingers and get that to change. So I would say that that, you know, people need to be clear-eyed about what marriage is. At the same time, we need to recognize the politics of the situation we're in right now in the United States and do our best to improve things over time, but don't expect immediate solutions.
All right, Eric, hope that helps. Keep listening to Catholic Answers Live and hope that you're supporting The Rock with your prayers and financial support whenever they go on the air and ask for that. And that goes for all of us who are listening to Catholic Radio. Please be sure and support your local station. Without you, they would not be on the air and you would have no Catholic Answers Live. So, all right, Angel or Angel, I'm not sure, in Anaheim, California, watching on Facebook. Is it Angel? Welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, welcome. The question I have is about ghosts. What is the Catholic stand on ghosts? Is there anything in the Bible? And I guess the second question that goes with it too is it possible for someone that dies to come back and give a message, deliver a message, or anything like that?
Okay. So earlier in the show, we mentioned that sometimes you'll have one word in Greek that has more than one translation in English. And this is an example of that. The Greek word for a spirit is pneuma. And that word gets translated in English both by the word spirit, which comes from the Latin root spiritus, and by the word ghost, which comes from the German root Geist. And so in English, we have two words for this one thing. The one thing is the immaterial part of a person, known in Greek as a pneuma. And in English, it's called both a spirit and a ghost. So since we have many passages in both the Old and the New Testament indicating that we have spirits that survive death, we have an immaterial part that doesn't cease to exist with the death of our bodies. Spirits are real. Or, to put it another way, ghosts are real. And so it's absolutely the case that ghosts are real. It's just another way of saying that spirits are real. In terms of can they come back ever or in some way manifest themselves to the living after they've departed this life? Well, sure. And we see examples of that happening in Scripture. Now, a famous example is when King Saul goes to consult, she's often called the Witch of Endor. Really what she was a medium who lived, or a trance channeler to use 1980s jargon, who lived in the town of Endor in the Holy Land. And she summoned up the spirit of the dead prophet Samuel. And that's exactly how Scripture presents this, that Samuel's spirit came back and gave a message to King Saul. Now, because he went to a medium and because God had forbidden the Israelites to use mediums to contact the dead, the message he came back with was not a happy one. He told Saul that he was in big trouble. And in fact, that he was going to die, and he then quickly did. So we don't want to be consulting mediums, but God also can allow the spirits of the dead to be seen, for example, in visions. And that's something that we see happening in 2 Maccabees, for example. The dead high priest, Onias, and the deceased prophet Jeremiah both appear in a vision. We also see that in Jesus' ministry on the Mount of Transfiguration, where Moses, who was dead, appears with Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. We see it in the book of Revelation, where John sees various souls of the departed who are in heaven. And so it's quite possible by God's will for the deceased to manifest in visions and perhaps in other ways too. But we want to be careful in how we approach these things, because a lot of the times, you know, reports of ghost stories and stuff are really just people's imaginations or tricks or things like that. In fact, in the 19th century, there was a movement called spiritualism, which was basically a bunch of hoaxes trying to convince people into thinking that spirits were manifesting when they weren't. So we want to be careful. We want to be prudent, but we also want to acknowledge the reality of spirits, or put it another way, ghosts, and the fact that they can sometimes manifest, but we also want to approach that with prudence.
All right, Angel, thank you. Glad we could help you with that on Catholic Answers Live. Many more of you still to come. This is hour number one of a two-hour Thursday Q&A open forum program with Jimmy Akin and you. The phone number for someone to grab that line that Angel was on in Anaheim is 888-318-7884. More of your questions are straight ahead. Don't go away.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Howdy folks, this is Jimmy Akin, and I have exciting news. Starting this spring, Catholic Answers Live will begin appearing weekly on EWTN television. What's more, you'll be able to watch it no matter where you are, from Catholic.com, using your computer, phone, tablet, smart TV, or other device. Catholic Answers' mission is to use every means we can to reach people with the message of Christ and His Church, and this will be our first weekly television program. That's why we need your help right now. Producing a quality professional television show is not cheap, and it can only happen with the generous support of donors like you. To make your donation and get a free copy of the videos, visit Catholic.com and click the Catholic Answers television banner, or call us toll free at 888-291-8000. That's the Catholic Answers television banner at Catholic.com, or call toll free 888-291-8000.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is that now there is. Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking resource by apologist Trent Horn. That one book that you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into or back to the practice of the Catholic faith. This Lent, plant seeds of faith in the hearts and minds of your non-Catholic friends and family. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today. You can order your copies of Why We're Catholic by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
St. Paul's street evangelization isn't like other evangelism you might have seen on the streets. We don't yell, and we don't force anyone to pay attention to us. Instead, St. Paul's street evangelization is committed to presenting a positive, passionately Catholic presence to a world hungry for truth. For more information, or to start a chapter of your own, go to www.streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com. It's time to do our part.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Very good to have you with us. There may never have been a more discussed and controversial and misunderstood and misrepresented writing of a pope, an encyclical in the history of the church, than Humanae Vitae, which came out 50 years ago. And a real special invitation and offer for you. If you don't really fully understand this issue, maybe you have people who are still not real clear on their church's understanding of artificial contraception and abortion and life issues and so forth. Catholic Answers Magazine, in the May-June issue coming up, is going to devote the whole issue to it. Jimmy has the cover article in there, and other articles are going to drill into different aspects of Blessed Pope Paul VI encyclical Humanae Vitae. So if you're not a subscriber yet to Catholic Answers Magazine, right now you're going to get either $10 off the normal price or $20, depending on whether it's a 1 or 2 year subscription, plus a free digital subscription. And this offer goes through the end of March. So consider subscribing right now. And one of the first issues you will get is this groundbreaking issue and discussion on Humanae Vitae. You can sign up at 888-291-8000 or on the internet at catholic.com. And also, just a reminder that so many people are still inquiring about the 20 Answers Challenge. 400 or so of you signed up for that just yesterday alone. Amazing response. So that offer has been extended for a short period of time at catholic.com. So 60% off and free shipping. Also online there at the shop.catholic.com. Okay, Mark Brumley is in the on-deck circle. Jimmy Akin finishing up this hour. And John is in Houston, has us on Guadalupe Radio. Hello, John. Welcome. You're next.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi, John.
As I was sitting on hold, I was contemplating the term apologist. And being raised a Negro, Black, or Catholic of African descent, I've had this conflict from the age of 5, and turning 60 this year, it is very disturbing to try to come to some understanding on how an African Hebrew Israelite, Yeshua ben Yosef, was turned into a Caucasian European king of the Jews. Now, whether you're going to be an apologist or not, or going to actually directly answer me, I doubt that may happen today. However, since the fact remains...
You can throw aspersions on my integrity if you want, but what's your question?
Aspersions, sir, I'm just asking that with the fact being the African origin of Catholicism, why are they dismissed if not outright falsified today?
Okay, so what evidence would you propose to show that Catholicism has an African origin?
Hello?
Hi. What evidence would you propose to show that Catholicism has an African origin? Because the great majority of scholars have concluded that it originated in Israel, which is not part of Africa. It's part of the Levant, which is joined to Africa.
Are you going to let me answer?
Yeah.
You see, again, here's the part of the fallacy here. How are you going to say that Egypt, which is an African nation, next door to Israel, as you just stated, claimed to be perpetuated as a part of the Middle East, when there's no Middle North, no Middle South, no Middle West? That's one thing. Secondly, the African nature and culture of Hebrews, that's what I'm trying to get you to understand. The letter J is only 500 years old. So when people keep referencing translations as Jesus, John, just like my name, a surname, the Baptist, all of these things are not even a century old, which means a letter J not existing in the Hebrew language, or the Aramaic references, or I guess you could say the same as we talk about certain languages have what we call, you know, breakdowns, because he spoke Aramaic, but he was taught in the same Hebrew that is being used in contemporary times that has no letter J. His name was Yeshua, not Jesus, not Yahushua. The letter I was then changed into J because the original Roman references was I-E-O-S-U-S. So when we start discussing these things, I have already proven to you factually that it was an African culture. This man was Semitic and melanated, not the perpetuation of what the Pope and the later under Constantine and imperialism, which then co-opted a belief system.
All right, John, pardon me for jumping in here, John. You asked Jimmy to listen to you, and he's given you plenty of time to, I think, lay out the basics of what you're getting at here. So we would just politely ask you to maybe give Jimmy a couple of minutes of time here.
Yeah, so I guess you've laid a number of things on the table there, John. Some of them are totally not controversial at all. Nobody claims that the letter J existed in Jesus' day, and nobody claims that his name was pronounced Jesus in his own day. You're right. It was pronounced Yeshua, in Hebrew, or Yeshua in Aramaic, to the best of our understanding, although there's a little bit of question there because there are different accents and dialects within Aramaic and within Hebrew. And so we can't be 100% sure of the record of exactly what it sounded like because we didn't have tape recorders back then. But yeah, I mean, his name was pronounced something like Yeshua or Yeshua. That's immaterial. It was also pronounced Jesus in Greek. And he was called that in the first century. That's the language that the documents of the New Testament are written in. Having said that, there are links between Israel and Egypt. They are right next to each other. The distinction between Africa and the Middle East is an arbitrary distinction, but if you it's a line drawn on a map, and you can draw the line in somewhat different places. But if you want to claim that the Catholic faith is of distinctly African origins, that's going to be understood as a claim, not in terms of it originated in Israel, but it originated farther south in Africa. In terms of was Jesus a person of color or melanated, as you said, frankly, who cares? He was the Son of God, and skin color differences are no more significant than hair color differences or eye color differences. Big deal, whatever his skin or hair or eye color may have been. He was the Son of God in human form, and he redeemed the entire human race regardless of their skin or hair or eye color. Now, having said that, the testimony of the New Testament is that Jesus was of Jewish origin, and based on what we know archaeologically in terms, for example, of skeletons we've dug up and ancient artistic depictions and so forth, Jews in Israel in the first century weren't particularly darkly complected. But like I said, so the evidence isn't that Jesus was darkly complected, but even if – regardless of what his skin color was, who cares? That's not what's important. All of that is just cosmetic. The fact is God loves all of us regardless of who we are or what color skin we have or what our eye color is or what our hair color is. Jesus loves all of us and died for all of us on the cross, and that's the important thing.
John, did you have a real quick follow? We got about 60 seconds before we got to get ready to end this hour of the program.
May I respond, please?
Quickly, yeah, quickly, John. We're just running short on time.
When he is dismissive in the statement he just made about who cares, that's not only insulting, it's falsifying the fact. Next, and this is very simply easily researched, when the Catholic Church purposely made white images, melanation is not about skin tone. It's about fact. If you bother to even look at Josephus the historian and Herodotus, they both reference these people as being dark-skinned. So when you say who cares, that part of the hegemony of perpetuating falsehood, how can you have true belief on anything based on a lie? And I part on this.
Okay, John, you're going to have to part on that note because literally we're going to have the closing music here any second for this hour.
Yeah, so just to respond very briefly, I have no dog in this fight. I don't care what Jesus' skin color was. If the evidence pointed to it being dark, fine with me. That would be great. If it points in another direction, fine with me. That's great too. It doesn't matter from God's perspective what your skin color is. And if Josephus or Herodotus said that that Jews in that time frame were dark-skinned, I would totally honor that evidence. But I've read Josephus, and I'm not aware of any passage where he says that. I'm quite sure there isn't one. Maybe there's something that's been mistranslated or misquoted in some sources you're looking at. But I am taking a neutral approach to the evidence, and really, though, like I said, the bigger issue is God loves all people, and we shouldn't get caught up in worrying about cosmetic issues because it's the heart that's important, not our external appearance.
All right, John, you go with our prayers and best wishes. And if you need further consultation, obviously we have limited time on the radio show, but Catholic Answer staff apologists can talk with you at greater length at 619-387-7200. Jimmy, where do people find you and your great wisdom online?
Well, they can find my piece about the new CDF document at Catholic.com tomorrow and also at JimmyAiken.com.
All right. Good to be with you again, Jimmy. Thanks.
Likewise.
Mark Brumley of Ignatius Press is coming up in the second hour. So Andrew and another John and Lamar and Brian and Terry, appreciate your patience through this short top of the hour break. Mark Brumley will help each and every one of you coming up next. 888-318-7884. Join us. 888-318-7884.